thousand times and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch today's show by going to ustream.tv and then searching for Gary Null. Today, we're going to begin with a discussion of inflammation, which most people have. Why most men and women over the age of 35 are deficient in DHEA and what that means and what you can do about it. Why oatmeal is really good for your heart and how all people over 50 should be using vitamin E. Alpha lipoic acid, it can fight two diseases simultaneously. From our environmental segment, we can now tell you that autistic behavior actually increased by banned pesticides, even 10 years after exposure. What does that mean? And a little-known Chinese herb can kill cancer anywhere in your body. And it's easy to get. It's non-toxic. I'll give you the latest on that, too. Increasing number of people suffer from allergic rashes from soap chemical. What kind of chemicals in our soap that causes rashes? Most people are not aware that it comes from that. Also, marathon training could help your heart. Well, we're going to be getting our marathon training shortly. And more on health and nutrition. Then we're going to look at some issues. And we're going to include today, from our investigative reporting issue, the subject of Obama definitely lied about having intent to prosecute banksters, from Eric Zeus from Global Research. After all, think, how many people have you heard from the major banks have been personally prosecuted? None? That's correct. We'll tell you why. And also a conversation he had with the bankers. Then a very unusual thing happened, and I received this from Dr. Tony Bark, medical doctor out of Chicago. It's all about a group that has been put together to attack anyone who says anything negative about vaccines, and they scour the web with the new technology that can identify any parent who has questions about vaccines and give them the correct, meaning official, position on vaccines and keep them away from those quacks and people who would give them misinformation, people telling you that vaccines are not safe or effective. But how this information ended up coming in an email is rather remarkable. I'll tell you about it, about a chance meeting in San Francisco. How much do you believe that our government is spending on the interest on debt in the United States? 2%, 1%, 4%, 26% of all available tax revenue goes to pay interest on the debt. Well, hold on a second. At the height of the Ottoman Empire's they started to borrow. And by the end of the Ottoman Empire in 1868, they were spending 17% of their entire tax revenue just to pay interest on the debt. But it got worse. And that crushed the Ottoman Empire. We're following the Ottoman Empire. I'll explain this. From Glenn Ford, from Black Agenda Reports, Obama expands Bush's fascist domestic and international infrastructure. A commentary. From Ralph Nader, casting sunlight on secret government and its contractors, from the Huffington Post. Those are some commentaries. Plus, I'll also be continuing what I started yesterday. We got a tremendous amount of positive feedback. I just felt it was time that we added to the program something that I did many years ago, but haven't in a long time, some commentaries on how we can live a happier, more authentic life. Part one was yesterday, part two is today. If you missed yesterday for any reason, you can go to the archives. Also, from the New York Times today, from the front page, I have it in front of me, and it says, Obama renewing U.S. commitment to NATO alliance. Well, that's a good thing, right? because nowhere in this article by Michael Shear and Peter Baker do they say anything negative about NATO. Not a word. Well, why am I not surprised? It's the New York Times, the best paper that administration and corporate Democrats ever had. I'll tell you a different story about NATO. In fact, here's what I'll do. I did an entire one-hour special challenging everything about NATO with two of the leading scholars in the world on NATO on the Progressive Commentary Hour. You can download it and listen for yourself. Once you hear what we have to say about NATO, all based upon facts, then you ask yourself, well, why would he be wanting us to commit to NATO? This is a criminal organization. Yes, it is. These are warmongers, absolutely. These are people who have no authentic position today. No, they don't. Then why is it in the front page of the New York Times, why is he not being challenged? Listen to the program, download it, get the other side of the story. If you can't, I will replay that next week on this airway. Also, finally today, well, they did it again. Do you recall recently the Denmark Zoo, the Copenhagen Zoo in Denmark, I should say, put down a completely healthy, very friendly giraffe to make room for some other animal? As an animal rights activist, as a person that has rescued a lot of animals, we're talking about thousands of animals that I've had brought to my home, or 73 horses that were dying on a ranch where the woman had gone broke and nobody had fed the animals and they were just bags of bones. Not one died. I brought them back to life. And buffalo that were sick, brought them back all the time, every day. And then I find a home for them wherever possible, or get them, release them in the wilds. This was so egregious to me, so we sent off a message that I would take the giraffe on my dime, my expense, so it could have a home, because I have facilities at my home for, I don't have them for cats, big cats, but I do have them for all hoof stock. And indeed, I have rescued and then rehabilitated, then gave to a 4-H club and an animal conservancy, camels, large animals. So this giraffe didn't have to die, but they did it anyhow. Well, they just did it again yesterday. They killed 4 lions, 2 young ones and 2 adults, to make room for another lion. To me, this is so outrageous, so egregious. What the hell is wrong with these idiots in Copenhagen? But that's where it stands. Didn't have to die. Clearly, this deserves some outrage on the people, on the behalf of the people in Copenhagen, to boycott the zoos, to stop supporting it. Everyone involved should be fired. These people do not deserve to be in custodians of any life that they could then arbitrarily and without thought end. I want your opinion on this, please. That'll be our talk back segment of our program, and I'll give it to you right now so you can think about what you want to say when you call in. From Dan Bilski, today's New York Times, quote, Denmark, the land of enchanted fairy tales and liberal social values, is becoming known as the land of dead zoo animals. The Copenhagen Zoo, which generated global outrage last month when it killed a healthy 18-month-old giraffe named Marius, said it had to euthanize 4 lions this week to clear the path for a newly arrived young male lion. The zoo's decision created a backlash on social media on Wednesday, with some calling the zoo's staff members serial killers murderers. The zoo justified the killings of the 2 parents and their cubs on the grounds of genetic purity. Genetic purity? You kill something based upon genetic... What red flag just jumps up at you right now? My God. He now goes on to talk about, they're not upset about it, and they'll do it again. What are your thoughts? Talk back. You'll have an opportunity. That number is 888-874-4888. Let's begin. oatmeal, but still cut oatmeal. There's several types of oatmeal. There's the instant oatmeal I do not recommend, but then there's the Irish or Scottish oatmeal because it's the whole grain. Now, you'll know the difference. It only takes about 5 minutes maximum to cook it. You don't need boiling water, just warm water, and it germinates it. It's kind of gelatinous. And then you add in your fruits and vitamin C and anything else you want, some maple syrup if it's raw organic, or if it's first grade and organic, that's fine. If it's some raw organic honey, that's okay. It's good for you. How good? From the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine, they have found that it benefits your heart. It protects you against heart disease. And that's really good. Quote, consumption of oats and oat-based products significantly reduces total cholesterol and low-density lipoprotein concentrations without adverse effects on high-density lipoprotein or triglyceride concentrations, end quote. And it keeps you full for about 4 hours. So, a good way to start the day. For anyone who's over the age of 40, and there are almost 100 million of us, we represent nearly one-third the entire population of the United States. We're not getting our vitamin E, but we should. From the Journal of the American Medical Association, a new study that when you're low in levels of vitamin E, you're going to have a physical decline if you're over the age of what many would consider middle-aged. This is according to Cornell University. So make sure that you're getting your vitamin E. Then another nutrient we don't consume in our society is alpha-lipoic acid. Can fight atherosclerosis and weight gain. Both are important. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Circulation. Here's what it says. Quote, lipoic acid supplementation reduces arterial lesion formation, triglycerides, blood vessel inflammation, and weight gain. And that, of course, are all models for heart disease. I'm suggesting between 200 and 1,000 units a day of alpha-lipoic acid. Also, if we don't get enough choline and betaine, we can end up with inflammation. But if you have a good B complex with choline and betaine, which is found in foods and supplements, then it's good for you and you turn off inflammation. And that's what we should be doing. The American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Calcium benefits adolescent bones. This is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. They enrolled a group of girls, 11 to 12 years of age, whose calcium intake averaged 636 milligrams a day. And then they gave them a drink containing 792 milligrams of calcium citrate. Or they gave them a placebo for 18 months. And then they followed them for 2 more years, where they received no supplements. And what they found was, at the end of 18 months, the girls who received supplemental calcium experienced significant gains in bone mineral content at all sites, except the hip. And bone mineral density also increased at all sites in the supplemental group, but not the placebo group. So, make sure your children are getting their calcium. Now, one thing that could help men help prevent a heart attack, DHEA. Now, DHEA improves blood markers for cardiovascular disease risk in men, and that means you could help prevent atherosclerosis by increasing nitric oxide production, which in itself promotes relaxation of the smooth muscle cells lining blood vessels. About 50 milligrams a day. There was a study where you got either 50 milligrams a day or a placebo, and you were followed for a period of time, and that found that it helped testosterone, platelet cyclic monophosphate concentration, which is a marker of nitric oxide. Your blood lipids were all improved. The placebo group did not. So, the takeaway message is DHEA, makes a big difference in men. And that was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Clinical Endocrinology. When I started filming for Autism Made in USA, the documentary, about 5 years ago, I found a group of physicians who belonged to what was called the DAN, D-A-N, group. That's a specific way of helping treat children with autism spectrum disorder. Remember, autism is not a specific condition. It is a series of conditions, from mild to major. And they all had something in common. They believe that environmental exposures of the mother into the developing fetus and of exposures such as vaccines and all the different ingredients from mercury and some to aluminum and polysorbate 80 and formaldehyde, all of these made a difference, plus the environment that a person was living in. So they tried to detoxify the children and to rebuild an immune system. And they had measurable success, including five of the people I interviewed were themselves medical doctors. One was a man, all the rest were women. One of the women was a professor of medicine at a major university and a pediatrician. And she said that her anger was at herself because here she was admonishing any of the medical students or nurses that suggested vaccines were dangerous. And she was 100% pro-vaccination until she vaccinated her own child and her own child developed autism spectrum disorder. And then she saw the denialism that is rampant within the medical community. This is the latest supporting their observations. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Health Perspectives. Now, according to Natural Society, this new research shows that a banned pesticide is causing increased incidence of autism and other behavioral disorders. Quote, this is the title of the article. Gestational exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and reciprocal social repetitive and stereotypical behaviors in 4 to 5 year old children, end quote. And it states that children who were exposed to higher levels of brominated flame retardant PBDE28 and trans nonochlor, a chemical found in banned pesticides and chlorodane, mind you, this is long after it's been banned, it showed higher levels of autistic behavior than those without such exposure. And for the study, 175 pregnant women were recruited to determine if exposure of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals collected through blood and urine samples would affect the developing fetuses. And the women who participated in the study were found to have over 44 suspected hormone-disrupting chemicals in their blood and urine. The study took 5 years because they had to go through the pregnancy and then see what happened. And the researchers found that children with the highest exposures of the trans nonoachlor in utero scored 4.1 points higher on the scale of those with less exposure, while those exposed to the brominated flame retardant PBDE28 scored an average 2.5 higher. This is more alarming considering that there are a host of pesticides that are currently being sprayed on our foods, which pregnant women ingest without even realizing it. So what is the message here? The message is that for those scientists and physicians and governmental agents and heads of agencies like the EPA and the White House, virtually all the presidents going clear back, including Jimmy Carter, have supported the petrochemical industry, which makes these pesticides. Not once can you name where the FDA, the EPA, the U.S. Public Health Service actively got ahead of everyone else and banned any of these. In fact, to the contrary, they're the ones who blocked these from being banned by saying we need more studies, we need more studies, and then allowing the people who are doing the polluting to control frequently the studies. DDT is a good example because I spent a lot of time fighting for the banning of DDT because even though this wonderful woman, who we virtually owe our environmental movement to, there's two people more than any human beings in American history who are responsible for our environmental movement and our protections. One is Ralph Nader. And he caused more laws to be put into effect, including our clean air, our clean water, our food protection laws, food safety laws, than anyone else in the history of Congress. But he wasn't a member of Congress. So it tells you something when a non-member of Congress causes more protection than anyone in Congress. And then one other woman, a marine biologist, Rachel Carson. That's what we have as far as on the pro side. All the rest of us, we're supporting their efforts. But Rachel was didn't feel comfortable in debates. So there were a lot of times when we needed articulate, strong voices to go out and say why pesticides were bad. It's a miracle that we ever got it banned, but we did. The trouble is, the day it was banned, there were at least 20 other pesticides equally bad, but we had no longer the energy nor the resources to fight every single one. The industry would just keep pumping them out. We should have simply had one law that said no substance can be put into the American public in the water or in the food or in any form that causes cancer in animals or humans or even lab rats in any amount. And if it does, it's banned. Oh, I forgot we did have that. It was called the Delaney Amendment. And the Delaney Amendment was banned by Bill Clinton. So we had a law that actually protected us. But they made sure the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans banned the Delaney Amendment. And today, nothing will be banned. So that's why we have to pay attention to how we keep our body detoxed, how we recognize that all pesticides, herbicides, fungicides are dangerous, unless they come from nature themselves, like spraying garlic, as I do on vegetables, then the insects don't like the garlic. Or you can take cayenne pepper, or you can crush up and dry mustard, the red mustard, and as it flowers, and then you mix that with some cayenne, and nothing touches a plant once that's sprayed on it. But instead, we go the easy way. Spray our grass, spray our hedges, spray for insects. And this stuff is toxic. And this study shows it. And then we end up with an epidemic in autism spectrum disorder and learning disabilities. And we refuse officially to look at the real culprits, environmental toxins. Something good that we can do to get rid of cancer. It is a natural Chinese herb. And when you consider how the rates of cancer are increasing and the number of people dying every year are about 550,000, we should pay attention to this, because according to the scientific journal Life Sciences, Cancer Letters and Anti-Cancer Drugs, this Chinese herb is a major cancer killer. Artemisium. Art. A-R-T, Emisia, M-E-I-S-N, I-N-I-N. It's a derivative of the wormwood plant and is commonly used in Chinese medicine, and it can kill off cancer cells, and it does it at a rate of 12,000 cancer cells for every healthy cell. So, there was a research team by a Dr. Lei at the University of Washington synthesized the compound, which uses a cancer cell model, and it shows its, quote, artemisium is 100 times more selective in killing cancer cells as opposed to normal cells. It is 34,000 times more potent in killing the cancer cells as opposed to their normal cousins. So the tagging process appears to be greatly increased the potency of artemisium's cancer-killing properties, end quote. That's from Dr. Lei. That's good news. I'm Gary Nall, here to talk about the issues that are important for us, at least those of us who are seeking a different model. Now, want to go to one of the emails. This email is from Darlene Jalil from Denver. And she says that, hi, Gary, I thank you for all your work, and I'm wondering if there's anything you would be able to do to help us fight HB 14-1288 in Colorado. It has passed the House, and it's an attempt to make having a personal vaccine exemption harder. It requires schools to make a list available to parents of what percentage is vaccinated. This will surely end up in a witch hunt of sorts, creating even more peer pressure to inject our children with poison. Please let me know if you can help. Thank you, Darlene. Darlene, there are several things that we can do. First and foremost, fight back with information that they cannot control. Go to blog.garynull.com. Again, blog, B-L-O-G, blog.garynull.com. As of right now, and because of your email, I have posted The Silent Epidemic. And it's the newest film documentary I have, the third, on the efficacy and safety of vaccines. That's all it addresses, nothing else. In it, I interview from around the world the leading toxicologists, vaccinologists, immunologists, pediatrician, educators, all experts, and I ask them a simple question. Can you show me the science that a single or multiple vaccine for any given person is safe? Can you show me whether it's effective, efficacious? Can you show me if it is harmful by itself or in combination with other vaccines? And can you show me that it's lacking in efficacy? Those are the four questions that are addressed. The entire film answers these questions, including one of the great law minds from New York University Law School, a professor who explains what your rights are as a parent and how they frequently lie to you at the local level to try to intimidate you into thinking that you better get your kid vaccinated. This is the best information that I have. Download the film, share it with others, and get as many people to watch the film as possible. Now, we've had 120,000 people watch it over a closed system, a private system, whereas some of the other films I've done up to date, millions of people have watched them online. This one, because we're engaged in a major campaign, and we're about to launch it in about another 3-4 months, so that's why I haven't put it out in the universe yet. But get it, and then there are articles. There's over 30 articles that challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines for adults and children and pregnant women. They're all fully referenced. And my standard is I never do an article that cannot withstand legal scrutiny. So all these articles will hold up in a court of law. They're all fully cited. They're fully scholared. So use them. Okay, that'll help you. Now, a few commentaries before we take our break. This is from Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. Quote, Barack Obama is one smooth operator, relentlessly expanding on the fascistic domestic and international infrastructure bequested him by George Bush, the cartoon cowboy imperialist. As we described him in 2012, Obama is truly the most effective evil, a president who routinely commits the most brazen aggressions under the lawless doctrine of humanitarian intervention, and who has utterly trashed due process and the rule of law on the domestic front. If you want to see fascism built right, get a black Harvard man to do it, and watch the internal resistance crumble. Although President Vladimir Putin has drawn a line against further NATO incursions and coups at his southern border, a move that most of Europe's inhabitants undoubtedly applaud, given that polls have long confirmed that the U.S. is seen as the number one threat to peace in the world, the U.S. public opinion reverts effortlessly to Cold War mode. Obama will have no problem gaining near-unanimous congressional support for the widest range of escalations against Moscow. from sanctions to natural gas wars to preparations for the shooting kind, while the ridiculous U.S. pseudo-left, personified by Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, snarks, an historically reversed narrative of post-1991 history in which Russia is constantly moving westward towards the English Channel. The president lowered himself to Stewart's level, or was it the other way around, baiting the Russians as less than manly. Quote, Russia is a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength but out of weakness, said the fracking PR man-in-chief. Obama issued his juvenile insults against the world's other paramount nuclear power at, of all places, a summit on nuclear security in The Hague, Netherlands. Tens of millions of eyes must have rolled among the U.S.'s southern neighbors when Obama said, quote, we generally don't need to invade them in order to have a strong cooperative relationship with them, end quote. Really? Mr. President, tell that to Haiti, 1994 and 2004, Cuba, 1961, Grenada, 1983, Panama, 1989, Dominican Republic, 1965. Neighborly nations directly invaded by U.S. troops, and to the people of Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Colombia, where hundreds of thousands perished at the hands of U.S. surrogates, and to the citizens of Chile and the rest of South America, virtually every country of which was taken over by militaries backed by the United States. And we're only talking about the post-World War II era. As we write, Obama pursues George Bush's policy of regime change in Venezuela, while the people still suffer under the heirs of the military coup he backed in Honduras in 2009. The list gets much, much longer if one includes the rest of the world as neighbors of the U.S. Certainly, the Americans behave as if everyone else's internal affairs are subject to Washington's approval, a negation of international law, and the real meaning of Obama's humanitarian military intervention doctrine. Responsibility to protect? Protect what? Profits? Under the first black president, the United States' non-recognition of international law has effectively achieved bipartisan acceptance. Indeed, much of what pretended to be anti-war movement under Obama's Republican predecessor is now in thrall of humanitarian warfare. And exactly what is that? President Obama has pulled off what George Bush didn't even attempt. He has established through the Congress and the courts preventative detention without trial as the law of the land, effectively nullifying due process. Having stripped citizens of their legal protections, he now bargains with Congress on the uses of the National Security Agency spy machinery that is already capable of monitoring literally every American plus unknown proportions of the rest of the world. Obama says he wants to limit telephone monitoring to 2 hops removed from the phone number targeted as suspicious in order to minimize the state's intrusion on the state's people's privacy. In fact, one court order allowed 2 hops would quite easily bring 10,000 telephone numbers under the National Security Agency surveillance, as U.S. District Judge Richard Leon figured out before rendering a decision against the NSA. The judge postulated that each of the 100 phone numbers called by the suspect or seed phone, that's the first hop, had called or gotten calls from at least 100 other numbers over 5 years, that's the second hop, totaling 10,000. A third hop would ensnare more than 1 million phones. Judge Leon's assumption are very conservative. If the national security state targets any affected political activists, they would reap far more than 100 numbers on both the first and second hops, probably enough to effectively map the bulk of the political activity among, say, peace groups. A third hop would round up multitudes of millions, including the barely committed and folks with no real interest in politics of any kind. One court order plus one suspect number plus 3 hops, every single person within the anti-war movement in America will be there from one single court order with one suspect's phone number and 3 hops. You've just rounded up and you're spying on every single anti-war activist in America. It turns out that the National Security Agency has for years been allowed to search up to 3 hops away from the suspect phone. They have undoubtedly already mapped every potential left-leaning, progressive, and ethnically suspect, meaning black, U.S. human network, having assembled millions of names and numbers. If George Bush or any Republican were president, leftists of all stripes would realize the clock is ticking, that they must radically alter the direction of the U.S. state or be in turn by it. However the smooth the fascist, Barack Obama is in charge, and there's a little sense of urgency on the left. End quote. Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. I'm Gary Nall. In a moment, we're going to get to our guest and get your calls. I'm going to open up for that and a few other short notes. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us. You're going to hear a lot of that kind of music at our disco party. It's our celebration of the end of the marathon on our sister station, WBAI. It's the second Wednesday in April. We were packed to the gills. Then we got a VIP area where we weren't supposed to be having. I didn't rent, but we did now. So we had some extra room, and we've got 16 places left. That even allows for a little extra. So then we're full. If you want to join us, it's free. It's a celebration party. Come to dance, socialize, couples, young, old, singles. It's going to be a wonderful evening, as all of our 50 previous parties have been. Give a call at 646-926-5422. 646-926-5422. And you can join us. Also, tomorrow evening, I look forward to our final evening. I've been going out regularly for Broadway plays, concerts, art movies, wonderful dinners, desserts. About 6 hours I spend with the people who supported the station, and our last evening is tomorrow evening. And then I had people who stopped and said, I'd love to have attended that and spent an evening. Sounded like a lot of fun, but I couldn't afford it. The money, of course, all went to the station. In fact, I've subsidized this out of my own pocket. And so here's the deal. Tomorrow we're going to Lincoln Center. We're going to have dinner, then go to Lincoln Center. And so if you want to join us, by all means, call that same number. If you pay for your own dinner and you pay for the play yourself and your transportation, then you can come. All right? So this way you're not left out. My guest, Dr. Bill Thomas, we're going to go to him. Then we're going to come back for your calls on our comment of the day about the zoo killing first the young, friendly giraffe, and then killing two lion cubs and the mother and father of them, all four, to make room for a new one, and with no thought of what they were doing except want to make sure that the genetic line was kept pure. 888-874-4888 is our number. Let's say hello to Dr. Bill Thomas. He is a MD. He's a visionary founder of the Changing Aging Movement. He's a graduate of Harvard Medical School. He is a geriatric physician who has a lifelong passion for working with the elderly. He's the founder of the Eden Alternative, a philosophical nursing home abolitionist program to deinstitutionalize nursing homes across the U.S., and the creator of The Greenhouse, a radical new approach to rip apart nursing homes and replace them with human-like environments based upon community and an interactive life. He's also a professor of aging studies, University of Maryland, Erickson School, and he is also the author of Second Wind, Navigating the Passages to a Slower, Deeper, and More Connected Life. Nice to have you with us today.
Glad to be invited.
Let's take a look at the baby boomer generation and its cult of adulthood and denial of living a more ethical and slower and deeper and more connected and sustainable life. Mm-hmm. Your perspective, please.
Well, my background and training is in geriatrics. So as a geriatric physician, I've spent a lot of time with older people. It's actually a wonderful, wonderful way to live, at least for me. And I've realized that our culture and our society are actually telling us the wrong story about aging. I actually discovered in my work with elders that aging is actually a very complex, rich developmental life phase. And American society is telling a different story, that aging is simply a matter of decline. There's no good in it, and there's no purpose to it. So I actually wrote a book about kind of attempting to reset the narrative away from decline and toward a more nuanced understanding of human aging.
Well, let's go through your most important messages.
Well, you know, I think the first thing is, you know, my work and the research that I've done really points to growth as being a lifelong imperative, that people actually are meant to develop all across the lifespan. So growth isn't something that just belongs to young people. It actually belongs to all of us. And the second, the importance of community and connectedness. And I was on the getting to listen to the show before I came on, and I heard you talking about your community building efforts and your efforts to kind of connect people in real life. And that's one of the things I've discovered in my work as well, that when we're connected to each other, we're actually all stronger and healthier than when we're isolated. And I think that I really applaud what you're doing there when bringing people together around common interests. And if I may say, I also heard you saying that all people of all ages are invited. And one of the things that I think is wrong with American society is the segregation of people by age, where older people and younger people don't have much of an opportunity to interact outside of family gatherings. That's something I'd love to see change.
When we think of the baby boomer generation, it's the radical movements of the 60s and early 70s that immediately come to mind as being the primary characteristics of this generation. And certainly it was the youthful rebellion at that time and the exploration mm-hmm. into non-Western religion and various mm-hmm. innovative psychologies and the alternative yeah. ways of living. And then there were the activist contingents who mm-hmm. took on social causes that departed mm-hmm. from the national status quo, mm-hmm. such as the protests against Vietnam, feminism, sexual mm-hmm. liberation, and civil rights. Mm-hmm. And together these provided a generational face or persona to the mm-hmm. wider American public and the mainstream media that flowed through television screens. And mm-hmm. however, and I want your opinion, the hippies actually made up only a small percentage of the boomer mm-hmm. generation, all the yeah. while remaining in silence was a much larger percentage of boomers who didn't raise their voices and continued to follow the traditional values handed mm-hmm. down by their parents in the dominant mm-hmm. society of the Great Depression. And talk to us about, it was this silent majority that eventually won out and has contributed to the creation of the dysfunctional cultural and uh-huh. social and career norms that dominate us today. Uh-huh. However, in all three cases, the hippies, the activists, and the traditionalists who are our generation, it was their path toward adulthood which were framed with their preoccupation in youth that defined each. So please begin by explaining in
sure.
greater detail
yeah.
some of the values incubated among the boomers that eventually became dominant and created what we call the cult of adulthood that defines so much of the boomer generation.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Actually, this probably, for me, as I was writing the book, one of the most exciting periods as this sort of began to emerge to me, that, you know, what had really happened, so to speak. You know, the dominant cultural narrative says, hey, you know, there was all this disturbance in the 60s and 70s and all these people kind of raising their voices. And then everybody grew up and everybody got quiet and there was no more revolution, no more revolutionary talk. And in fact, what I discovered is the revolution was just beginning. And what this baby boom generation has done, not individuals, but the generation has done, is actually transformed and remade adulthood in a very hyperactive, hypercaffeinated, extremely performance-oriented vision. So we don't have an adulthood, a vision of adulthood that's really balanced between health and wellness and rest and leisure and work. We don't have this vision that, you know, we should earn our daily bread and then invest ourselves in art and creativity and self-expression. Instead, we live in a society that says, hey, no matter how hard you're working, it's not hard enough. No matter how much you're making, it's not enough money. No matter how big your house, it could be bigger. In other words, what happened is that the somewhat temporary social rebellion of the youth of the baby boom generation gave way to a real revolution that actually robbed you and me and all of our listeners, robbed us of this opportunity to have a really balanced, much more holistic approach to our lives as adults. And we're trapped. We're all trapped inside of this construct where we don't get to have the kind of freedom and the kind of self-expression that we really all deserve. And that, to me, was the biggest insight as I was writing the book, the biggest moment of, like, wow, as sort of the curtain parted. And I began to understand the degree to which this post-war baby boom generation, of which I'm a kind of trailing member, actually remade American society in its own image. It's just astonishing to me.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. My last comment is this. It is my view that our culture is stuck with the paradigm that adulthood is the end of life's journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That we pass through developmental stages of youth and adolescence into adulthood, and that frames the remaining of our lives. And I think that is completely limited. Our lives are greater than the stories we're told to live by.
Mm-hmm.
Our sensations, feelings, fantasies, and desires exceed the smallness by which we are dictated to follow the rituals. Most of our lives are boring because we are taught to be boring. Mm-hmm. We are conditioned not to act out, not to speak up, and not to show strength of character that defines us against the definition of a socially accepted creature. And that's not true with other cultures, particularly indigenous societies that frame mm-hmm. adulthood in the context of dynamics working between the community and raising a family. And at the conclusion of that, adulthood ends and the older members of the tribe become elders or sages.
Yeah.
We don't have elders or sages in our society. We have nursing homes and senescence and we do not accept or respect this. We fight against it. And I'm saying, if you stop being boring, if you broke out of your conditioned cubicle, if you became the person you were meant to be, if you lived through the divineness of your own spiritual sense, then you wouldn't be bored. You wouldn't look for Duck Dynasty or the Cardassians to distract you. You would look at your life each day as a dynamic example to how to live it all over again today and start fresh. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, this is where in a long list of examples where traditional societies actually have a lot more to teach us than we have to teach them. And, of course, you see this in many aspects of medicine, but also in terms of culture. As you were referencing, the vast majority of cultures around the world and through history have actually possessed a station in life beyond adulthood, that you could actually come to the end of your adulthood and be initiated as an elder of the tribe or community, and that in that new role as tribal elder, you actually were given, actually, a more influential voice than you had when you were a middle-aged adult, as you said, busy raising a family and rearing children and so on. That these elders actually came to be the voices who would speak on behalf of those who could not speak, that the tribal elders actually were positioned in a way to have a large degree of influence over the rearing of children, the transmission of culture, and I think perhaps the most important thing of all, these elders were able to place a gentling hand on the shoulder of adults and just cause adults to pause and think and reflect, and in doing so took the edge off some of the I think natural excesses of adulthood. So what I'm arguing for in the book and what I believe in is that it's your job, Gary, my job, Bill, and the job of all the people listening to us, actually to create a new elderhood, one that as not a tribal elderhood, because we don't live in a tribal society, but an elderhood that fits our condition, our culture, our society, and becomes that voice that speaks for more ancient kinds of wisdom in modern American society. And we're all suffering from the lack of that voice. So to kind of pull it together, you know, the ideas that I discovered and wrote about in the book are really a lot. I know a lot of your work has been based on exploring wisdom that exists in the world but has been lost to us because of the dominant narrative. I think I've sort of taken the same path you've taken, but my focus has really been cultural and on the need to reinterpret this very damaging story about aging that's been told to us, and the need for all of us to sort of outgrow in our proper time, outgrow adulthood, and become the elders that we all need.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Just a final thought.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the average American today, no matter what their age, and you're looking at a variety of emotional, mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, loneliness that plague most Americans in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the generation, we are motivated by speed, productivity, and effectiveness. A kind of egocentric, self-cherishing preoccupation with our own individuality and personal needs. And when a society emphasizes the individual, and we see this clearly in the horde of self-help books and workshops on bestsellers consistently during the past several decades, it is predictable that community health and cohesion between members of the social collective would be fragmented and dysfunctional or even non-existent. And I believe that this has damaged us because then we're all reading from the same very tragic Greek tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And look at Wall Street. Look at the people who are elected officials, the CEOs, the chairmen and chairwomen of major multinational corporations. We're clearly witnessing their extreme denialism, not only regarding the consequences of their own actions and policies, but also the denialism of the larger picture and view of life, meaning the interrelatedness between our free market capitalism and our government policies that fuel it, and the injury it causes to multitudes of people, not just in the United States, but around the world. And that is because these people, whether it's the Clintons or the whole Clinton-esque concept of trying to act like you're an activist when you're really a conformist to the extreme, and so is Obama. And in this context, you don't want to share. You don't want to care. You're not going to nourish the world. You're not going to care about the young, the old, the schools. All you care about at this point is what's good for you. Any final thoughts on this, please?
Well, you know, we don't think of it usually in this way, but as your comments, you know, highlight, old age is a social construction. It's a story we tell ourselves about who we are and how we live, and we make it, we create it, and the beauty of that is that we can recreate it. And I'll just kind of wrap up with sort of a couple of ideas late in the book. Where I look at people who are out there reinventing themselves, reinventing their culture, repossessing words that have been used against them. One very quick example is women, including some of the women listening to us, have gone out and reclaimed the word crone, which originally meant wise, a woman wise with age, and was turned into an insult, during the witch hunts of the Middle Ages, and they're going out and actually reclaiming that word and saying, yeah, we are women wise with age, and they're creating a new culture. And from my point of view, they're the hope, the folks who are willing to challenge the accepted orthodoxy and willing to act to create a new narrative. These are the heroes of our time.
I would agree. Dr. Bill Thomas, thank you for being on, and all the best with Second Wind.
Thank you so much, Gary. Take care.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're up to the end of the program, and most of our stations will have to say goodbye, but I'm going to continue on and take calls on our line for people who'd like to express their opinions on the euthanizing, the killing of these lions, this whole family of lions, and that baby giraffe, and what will clearly be ongoing killing of other innocent creatures that entrusted their lives to this group of very callous people. Our number is 888-874-4888. For everyone else, thank you all for listening, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Tim from New Jersey. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Gary. I think that those people that were entrusted with the caretaking of the animals should be removed and replaced with suitable people, definitely.
Good, I would agree.
They should be held responsible in some way, too, for their actions.
They can't be held responsible because what they did was not illegal, but it was sure immoral and unethical. And you should email the government, the parliament, the people at the Copenhagen Zoo, and let as many people as you know over there by email know that this was not something you support, all right?
Gary, I found a quote by Rachel Carson.
Yes.
In an age when man has forgotten his origin and is blind to even his most essential needs for survival, water, along with other resources, has become the victim of his indifference.
Brilliantly said by her. Thank you for sharing that with us, Tim.
You're welcome, Gary. See you.
And let's take another call here. I need some names, please. Don't have them. We'll say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a question for you based on what we've just heard. When you look at our culture, we remember people for what inspired us originally, which is why we still listen to Elvis Presley. He's making a lot of money on his hits. We listen to old music. We read old authors. And recently there was even a show with Carole King, just one of the most talented people we have. And, I mean, she wrote for the Shirelles and the Drifters, and then she went on to other genres, and then she wrote her own music, and then it stopped. People like the Four Seasons, Hall & Oates, the people that we grew up with, Elton John, Cher, they've not had new material. So my question for you is, these people are creative, and they've given us some amazing creative work. Why do they stop?
I'm going to answer that, but I promised people I'd let them in on a final question. Let me say hello to Nasha for Queens. Nesha, it's your turn. You have to make your statement short.
Hi. I made some progress. I went to a rally in New York for the carriage horse.
Good.
I gave a flyer to Tony Avila about putting in antique cars that people would really love instead of the carriage horse, and he went ahead with it. And that is due to your influence. So I want to thank you and let all the listeners realize that what might be a small action can really get action.
I absolutely believe in that. Thank you for doing that, Nesha.
You're welcome.
Now back to Luann. Luann, rephrased it in this context, and I think it makes more sense. We've all seen performers from the past that we really enjoyed, but when we go to see them, we're not looking for them to have new work. We're going because we're attracted to what they created that we considered remarkable in the moment that we experienced it. And hence, having a 30 or 40 or even 50-year-old act get up and sing, and sing something that we connect to, that's what's important. Very few of these people, however, continue to transcend barriers and limitations, because suddenly one day someone wakes up and says, you know, disco's dead, let's go to something else. You know, rockabilly's dead, let's go to something else. So the people who are profiting from creating the next venue, the next ideal that we're supposed to embrace, those people don't care about the careers or reputations or the livelihoods or the interests of either the general public. They're just there to market them something, or the performers that they're going to have replaced, and they don't care. And what has to happen is that when you're in a performing situation, no matter what that performance is, you have to realize that you have an expiration date, and don't take your success seriously, and save your money so that at some point you're in a position where you can personally continue to produce or to write or to perform. If not, then you're under contract and you're held captive to having had a hit or two or ten, and then you're gone. I'm quite sure if Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons wanted to redo some songs today, they could easily do it. They had the money and the resources to write music together, to go into a studio, to record something. But would the DJs play it? Would anybody be interested? Possibly, possibly not. But unless you try that, you'll never know. And those people who always seem to be just at the eclipse of a career suddenly revitalize themselves because they changed. They did something new and got ahead of themselves. So instead of having someone replace themselves, they replace themselves. So the ability to deconstruct and clear your image and the stories of that image and recreate yourself, the people who are able to recreate themselves have a continuing career. Those who are not, don't. And that's how it works. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about President Obama's revisionist speech in Brussels yesterday, and we're talking about a heck of a court battle that's coming up in Detroit on April the 1st as the federal bankruptcy judge receives challenges to the city's plan to get out of the hole.
I don't know if you've dealt with this or you want to, but I'm concerned about a movement in water privatization. And in the city of Detroit, they're using it as an example. If you are late on your water bill, they'll take away your home because they have now tied in the mortgage structure of a person's home with their water. And the city's coming in, unless you have children. If you have children, you're given a stay for a period of time. But if you don't, they want those homes. Now, why would they want empty homes? Why would they want you out on the street? And then you have to know about all the consortiums of hedge funds and equity partnerships and private investment syndicates that are buying up hundreds of thousands of vacant homes for pennies on the dollar and mm-hmm. then grouping those into packages and then selling them just like they did the subprime mortgage packages where the person that gave you the mortgage is no longer there. It's already been sold and to a supposed rental market. In point of fact, all the studies show that people can't afford to rent now. And unless you're in a very highly desired location, like on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But otherwise, it's just one big game, and they're doing it all in the city of Detroit right now.
That's why Detroit, I keep saying over and over again, Detroit is a template for what's going to be happening in other major cities.
You're absolutely right. We look forward to your show, Utrice Lead, right now.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough. Oh, baby.